Marx follows the ever-changing landscape to discuss the latest pressing issues relevant to brand owners in Europe and beyond. During this series, Marx members and special guests share updates, experiences, and opinions. This is IP Law Today. This is Talking Marx.
Hello and welcome. I'm James Nurton, Marx editor and podcast host, and I'm very pleased to introduce the Talking Marx podcast. In today's episode, I'm joined by Roland Mallinson of Taylor Wessing in the UK and Stamattia Tirozzi of Red Bull in Austria to discuss all things Brexit as businesses prepare for the changes coming in January 2021. Roland, I'd like to start with you. Back in November 2017, Marx said that Brexit had the potential to be a material threat to IP owners' interests. Do you think that threat has been avoided?
Hello, James. Yes, thank you. We issued a paper back then which included that statement. At the time, we said that the UK government, the Commission and the 27 member states should prioritise three things. First one was to make sure there was no loss of proprietary IP and no reduction in IP protection. The second was that there should be minimal cost in this process of maintaining existing rights. And the third, minimal or no administrative burdens to be created in retaining those rights. And overall, on balance, I think actually most of those have been achieved, which is very pleasing. And I can't say that Marx has necessarily swung it, but it's pleasing that those goals have been achieved. I think essentially the UK comparable right that's been created is going to give that continuity of protection. There's an erosion really that's arisen just in the administrative side, particularly. You can't get pan-EU injunctions now that will straddle the UK and Europe, which is a shame. And the same way, you know, from either the UK courts or the EU 27 courts. And there is a new unregistered design right being created in the UK, the supplementary right, which is welcome. But there is a concern that certainly designers publishing in the UK first won't get the right in Europe necessarily. That's uncertain. But at least pre-existing rights are going to survive. And whilst there's talk about having fashion shows that are simultaneously broadcast in the EU27 so that you can get both rights, the case law doesn't necessarily tell us that. Marx did suggest in our position paper in 2017 that the UK comparable rights that get created out of an international registration of an EU designation shouldn't fall outside the umbrella of the international registration. Unfortunately, that's not happened. So they will now split out and the parent will be divorced from the child as such. And that's a shame. But at least the pre-existing pan-EU injunctions that have been granted by the courts should still apply. So that's all quite good news.
So overall, good news then, and processes have been put in place. Stamattia, how do you think this process of comparable rights that Roland has discussed, how has that been from your point of view? Has that worked well? Has it been smooth?
Hi, James. Thanks for having us. Well, I think that with respect to comparable rights, there is no insecurity with respect to protection in the UK. So I think we have sufficient coverage. And I think that this was something that was welcomed by all companies and IP rights owners. And I think this was something that was smooth. And we are happy to have that. Also, the 9-month transition period to apply for a comparable UK trademark for all EU pending trademark applications. I think this has also been welcomed. And I think the 9-month period gives sufficient time to the IP owners to secure their pending rights also within the UK. So with this respect, I think that it was the case that there is no insecurity with respect to IP owners and the situation was handled in a good way, I would say, from a UK and EU IPO perspective.
Well, that's good news, and that's a good note to look forward to next year. Roland, do you think there's been enough information throughout the process from both the EU and UK sides and that you know people have been able to plan effectively for the changes that are coming?
I think it's been intermittent. I mean, there's now a lot of information out there. I have to say it's easy to find, I think, on the EU IPO's Brexit hub. The UK IPO site is sort of spread around, lots of guidance notes. and they have been updated over time, and they were slow, I think, at the first to really put out anything helpful. I don't know. I mean, the fact is that the information is there now, but some of it's only come. I mean, for example, the stuff on the international registrations has really only come out in the last few weeks in some instances, and that's not been ideal.
Stamatia, what do you think? Have you experienced any problems with the communication or transparency, or do you think it's been okay?
Internally, we base our decisions and strategic planning based on our council's external consults and evaluations, and not mainly on the information to be found on the trademark office sites. And from this respect, I have to say that I think that the information provided by the EU IPO was much more user-friendly than the one from the UK IPO. And with terms of timeline, we all experience, and I think it's a common fact that we experience, that there have been announcements from the UK IPO, for example, with respect to international registrations designating the EU and the address of service for the UK only very recently. And even though IP owners were preparing for a long time, there have been decisions to have been made also in the last minute, 1 month before the official end of the transition period for the great Brexit situation. So in this respect, we had to be alerted and flexible. But I mean, in the end of the day, the changes that have been introduced were not fundamental, but still we had to adapt ourselves to the last communications issued by the UK IPO. And I think the international trademark registration topic was something that was faced with a bit of disappointment by the IP owners, because the EUK IPO or the authorities decided that they will split the parent from the children with respect to trademark rights. And I think this is a bit unfortunate, but we need to take it from here now and decide whether it would make sense to make replacements or not.
So that will be a decision that you as trademark owners and applicants will have to make, and I guess each company will do it kind of case by case.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, one has to evaluate the pros and cons in this situation and decide if it makes sense for them to bring back the child to the parent or not, and the cost efficiency ratio in that sense, because obviously it's not for free, so it will cost money to bring back the child to the parent.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, Stamatia. We're finding not many of our clients are going to be that interested in that option. I mean, whilst it is an option, it seems pretty unlikely that many will go for it.
Roland, are you confident that the UK IPO will be able to handle this transition process with the comparable rights? I think it's something like 1.4 million trademarks and 600,000 designs they're going to have to create on December 31st.
Well, I'm as confident as they're confident, and they're expressing their confidence that they can do it. I mean, thankfully, the end of the transition period falls on a bank holiday, so they've got 3 days. They shut down at 11 p.m. on the 31st, and they're telling us that on the 4th of January, when the office reopens, the data will be there. Although they are saying actually that the Hague international design designations will possibly not come on stream immediately. But they like to think that everything will come across. They are going to need more time to do, or so they say, up to possibly a month or so to do all the any changes of representation. But in terms of the data coming across, they say it'll happen over those 3 days. And I like to believe that they're going to do so.
Let's all hope so. I think we all want to see a smooth process, whatever happens. So we've talked about some of the things which are clear and which have hopefully worked well. Stamatia, what do you think are the main areas of uncertainty as you look ahead to next year?
Until 1 week before or two, the uncertainty was still the ERs, which have been clarified now, and this is now a strategic decision, so the formality has been clarified there. I think it's a complex process, but as Roland said, you would have to evaluate on a case-by-case basis. So this is the one thing. The other is how the UK courts will continue to interpret the European case law. And I mean, honestly, this will, it's not an uncertainty, but it's something we will have to consider even more and more. And I think it will be a fading off period, to be honest. This would be my assumption, because the longer the period in which UK is not a member of the EU anymore, the more the validity or the strength of a European case law will fade off. This is my personal opinion, but maybe Roland would see it differently. But I think in the beginning, probably the UK courts will probably take into consideration the case law from the European Court of Justice or even other national courts within the EU to see and decide on UK cases. But I would say in like 5, 3, 10 years time, this will not be the case anymore. I hope we will not have another exit issue by then. So we'd have to consider this for another EU member state. But
so you think there'll be a gradual divergence over time?
This is my assumption. But I let Roland put his opinion forward, because it's just my assumption.
Well, Roland, do you agree? I mean, I suppose there's two ways that it can diverge. The UK could diverge with its own decisions, but equally, if the European Court of Justice takes certain decisions which the UK doesn't follow, that could lead to divergence as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's the potential for divergence, of course. I think there'll be a general desire to try and keep a degree of harmonisation, I think. But obviously, we've got to consider two things, both the law itself and then the interpretation by the courts. And I mean, the Withdrawal Act 2018 said that when we leave on the 31st of December, or the end of the IP period, on the 31st of December, the courts will apply the CJA UK case law as it was then. And so those cases will still continue to apply. There has been a change in the, actually it's in the pipeline right now, a consultation from the government to possibly change which courts can deviate from CJA UK case law. At the moment, only the Supreme Court can, or that was the original intention. And there's now a regulation going through the Parliament right now, which is possibly extending that to the Court of Appeal, which means our friend Lord Justice Arnold, amongst others, could then have the freedom to deviate from CJU rulings. But I don't think he's desperate to do so. And I think there's a general intention to reflect CJU case law. But if either the parliamentary acts change the law, then obviously we'll deviate potentially. But I do think there are some areas where the English judges might be tempted, certainly the appeal court judges upward, might be tempted to deviate. I mean, they've expressed frustration, I think, in the past over some CJE case law on the scope of protection of free riding and also for 3D shape marks. And those areas, I suspect, might be the first that will slightly deviate.
Interesting. So we'll all be watching out for that. So we just have a minute or so left. I just want to ask each of you if you have one practical tip for trademark or design owners and applicants as we go into next year. Maybe Roland, starting with you.
Yeah, I think there's one that's been troubling those who administer trademarks is to how to engineer the transition, particularly in terms of if there's going to be a change in the representation or the addresses and things. And one I think that could be quite helpful is that if you can set up at the EU IPO two representatives. It's not commonly done, but it is certainly possible. And so you could have your first representative as the UK IPO representative, and the second would then be your future EU27 representative if you're going to have different ones. The advantage then is that automatically on the 31st of December, the UK IPO will pick up the first address and use that for the new UK comparable right. And then the EU IPO will delete that first address if it's a UK non-qualifying representative and will then put in place the number two. And that way, both offices will then automatically deal with the split. So that may be something quite helpful to do, but obviously you need to get that in place before the 31st.
Need to act quickly, but it's a good tip for people to consider, isn't it? And Stamatia, what about you? Do you have any final tips for your fellow brand owners before the transition ends?
Yeah, from a practical point of view, the IP owners and trademark owners have to check their records. They have to ensure that they duplicate the records in order to have the UK and the EU trademark split. So from an admin point of view, this is important in order to ensure that you will work smoothly also after the 1st of January. And the second one would be to check your evidence of use within the UK to ensure that you will be able to support the use of your trademarks also after Brexit, because I understand that the UK IPO will for some time consider EU evidence, but this will also gradually fade out. So one needs to ensure that they have enough evidence to support the use of their trademarks in the UK.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you, Roland. Thank you, Stamatia, for some very useful discussion and practical tips for people today, and for giving us your time. It's good to have you with us on this first Talking Marks podcast.
Thank you, James.
Thank you, James. Been a pleasure.
Join us again soon for another podcast on an important issue for brand owners. To find out more on our website and guest speakers, visit marks.org/podcast.